Invitation. I must admit that it is my first time in a mathematical physics conference, and one of the things that I realized is that the culture, it is totally different from the physics conference cultures that I'm used to. I enjoy very much the environment over here, so thank you again for giving me the opportunity to participate in this meeting. And probably you already realize that there is a change between the title that I have announced and the title that I'm going to give. And until the last minute, I have to admit again that I was fighting between these two titles, simply because the last part of the talk, which was supposed to be the main part of this talk, it is totally new. We are working on it a couple of months. We don't have real conclusions over there. Nevertheless, I decided that it makes sense to present it to a conference, mainly because I am coming from the specific school which is pushing the people to present in conferences questions than wise answers. So this is what I'm going to do over here. This is again the title of the talk. I will view graphs from the physics point of view, and I will use them as models to describe quantum complex dynamics and mesoscopic phenomena. And here it is the list of collaborators over the years. Joshua Bodifel, he's my PhD student at Wesleyan University. Doron Cohen, a very old friend and collaborator with whom we develop a new activity on networks. Theo Geisel, Matthias Pullman from my previous institute, and of course my two long-term collaborators on networks, Uzis Milansky, who essentially introduced me to this field, not only me, but also many others, and Holger Hans, who I enjoy many discussions with him, and who was able throughout the last years to turn my physical stupid questions to mathematically sound answers. And let me go to the next transparency. Suppose that with the page down, it has to do the job. I tried Ender also. Sorry? I try Enter. It doesn't do anything. Okay. Oh, now it's too much. Okay. Okay. So now I learn how to use this thing. And this is an outline of my talk. I will start with an introduction, where I will remind to you the ideas coming from classical house. Then I will connect these things with the next level, which is wave or quantum chaos. And once I will do this, I will discuss the main ingredient or the main philosophy that underlies all the studies of quantum house, namely the idea of universality. And once I will enter this game, I will connect the idea of universality with random matrix theory as a general tool to attack to questions associated with universality. And once I will enter this point, then essentially I draw to you the main framework over which people from quantum house, they are operating. And then, of course, I will ask the need of introducing models that they will show universal properties, and they will allow us to develop tools that they go beyond universality. It will pump up very obviously, and this is the point where mesoscopic networks or quantum graphs, they will appear in my talk. Now, once I will introduce quantum graphs, then the next step that I will ask it is what I can do with them. And here it is a set of things. This is not the only things that I can do, but Obviously, in 1 hour, you cannot discuss all the stuffs that you can do with them. Namely, I will concentrate in using semi-classical techniques and methods in order to understand various stuffs. And I picked up three things which they are associated with spectral statistics. I will discuss the form factor and how it is connected with ideas coming from random matrix theory. Then I picked up something that it is associated from wave functions, and I will discuss scattering phenomena and how quantum graphs, they allow us to understand scars. And eventually, I will discuss dynamics. So I'm going from spectral, wave functions, and eventually I will go to dynamics, and specifically I will discuss the issue of current relaxation. Now, these are works that they are already published and done, and this is the point where, you know, I was arguing with myself to present it or not. Namely, if one can use, and I will show you how you can do something like that, networks in order to describe ultra-cold atoms. And here I don't have many answers. I have, though, many questions. And this is the part that I will present. And by the end of the day, and hopefully this is not going to be the end of the day, but the end of the hour, I will overview. So here it is a cartoon that gives you the main idea of classical chaos. And allow me the freedom to introduce classical chaos the way that the physicists can understand. It's very simple. You start with two initial trajectories that they are so close to one another that you cannot really resolve them. And then you are evolving them in time. And what you are observing it is after some time, the dynamics of this very simple system, few degrees of freedom, 2 degrees of freedom system, takes one trajectory over there and the other one exponentially far apart. And essentially, this is the definition of classical chaos that I will use in this talk. Namely, the exponential sensitivity to initial conditions, which can quantify through the positive Lyapunov exponent, which is the rate over which the two trajectories, they are diverge from one another. Now, as a packet deal of this exponential divergence of very close initial trajectories, it goes also the fast decay of various correlators. And again, here you can see one of these correlators, namely the position-position correlator. You correlate the initial position with any other, the position at any other time, and because simply you cannot really know if the particle will go here or there, you are losing immediately the correlation. And these are going as a packet together. And to my understanding, what, you know, really classical chaos brought to our life something like 50, 60 years ago, it is essentially this great thing that few degrees of freedom can generate a stochastic-like behavior. So it is fair to say that as far as classical dynamics is concerned, we are having quite a good understanding. Of course, the question is what happens once you realize that previous century and even this century, it is something that has to do with quantum physics, and how the traces of classical chaos, like the instability of orbits, that the sensitivity of orbits that I discussed previously, decay of correlators, and so on and so forth, they are penetrating quantities that they are having to do with the Schrödinger equation, and this is the time-independent Schrödinger equation, and namely, what you would like to ask, what are the fingerprints of classical chaotic dynamics, say, in the spectra or in the wave functions? And in fact, that was the question that initiated at the beginning of the 80s the field that in our days we are calling wave or quantum chaos. And this is the field over which quantum graphs, they are appearing as a very appealing model to understand various questions. Now, as I said at the very beginning, one of the main ideas underlying all the studies of quantum chaos or wave chaos is the idea of universality. Now, what I mean by universality, you can see it in this, in this plot over here, where I have three different systems, like this cavity. This is a microwave cavity. The figure, it was taken without the permission of Stockman. It is coming from the group of Marburg. And what you can see over there, it is the Sinai billiard, and the density plot indicates one specific mode. It is a highly excited mode. This is an example that is coming from atomic physics. It is the cesium atom in a monochromatic field. And this is an example that is coming from mesoscopic electronic physics, where you are having a quantum dot, where you are sending an electron passing through this cavity, which is remnant of Bunimovich stadium. And what you are doing as a next step, you calculate the levels, the spectrum of these three different examples, and you calculate the density of states, which is nothing else than the sum of delta functions position at the spectrum, and you correlate the density at the position epsilon at the position epsilon plus high. Maybe you would like to perform an average over different central points epsilon, and this is a quantity that operates in the energy space. Now what you are doing, you are Fourier transforming this quantity, and then you are coming out with a creature which is very dear to us, and it is called form factor. This is a quantity that operates in the reciprocal space, the time domain. And here are the exact results coming from these three different systems, and you can see the green line, which is the experimental data. In my talk, experimental, real experimental, or numerical experimental, they will interchange in a free way. So every time that I'm talking about experiment, you can think either way. And what you can really see is that all three systems, they are sharing more or less the same form factor. And there is a line, which is a blue line over there, and this is a line that is coming from the random matrix theory prediction, which is actually a zero information theory. Random matrix theory, or you already discussed this thing, it gives only information about the symmetry of the system. Nevertheless, what you can see it is that this zero information theory produced quite well the statistical properties of the spectrum as far as the form factor is concerned. Of course, there are deviations, and in fact, the field of quantum Gauss care mainly about these deviations. Now, this universality, or, you know, deviations from this universality to this degree, they appear not only as far as the level statistics is concerned, but you can see it also in wave functions and possibly in dynamics, although for the last thing, I would like, you know, to keep save trace, and I will not really discuss universality on this frame. Now, let me reproduce the main avenue in order to calculate the form factor as far as random matrix theory consideration is concerned, and I will calculate the form factor for unitary matrices. These are matrices that they are coming if you consider some type of an evolution operator, or if you consider some type of a mapping. As unitary operators, they are having eigenvalues phases e to the I theta n, and it is the corresponding eigenvector of this U matrix. And of course, I can calculate the density of phases, which is nothing else of a sum of delta function modulo 2 pi. The phases, they are living in a 2 pi cycle. Once I calculated this thing, I can calculate the density-density correlator, which is essentially I correlate the position theta with the position theta plus high, an average over various initial states, and I divide by the mean level spacing. The mean level spacing, it is nothing else than 2b. 2b is the dimensionality of my U matrix, divided by 2 pi. 2 pi is the total available space over which I can have the eigenphases. Now, if I do this, I can substitute the definition of the density d over here, and then I come out with this double sum. And the next thing that I have to do, it is I have to take the Fourier transform of this quantity, and this is what I am doing, and I call this object small kappa of t. Next step, I substitute the correlator in this integral, and if I perform an integration over dx, then this turns down to the double sum over the difference of the phases, which essentially it is nothing else than the sum over n of the phases absolute value square. This is just a simple product. So this thing, it is nothing else than the trace of the evolution operator to the power t, absolute value square, divided by 2b. And of course, what people they are doing, once they will come to this point, they have to perform some type of an averaging. Now, before talking about this averaging, which is the main issue of the first part of this talk, I will also mark the fact that there was an assumption. ANSAS goes back to 80s, as far as this matrix is concerned. It goes to an assumption of Smilansky, that actually this function, it is a function of the rescale time, which I will call it tau, and it is nothing else than the actual time divided by the dimensionality of my space to be. And the question, again, it is, what does this average mean? And random matrix theory gives us a set of answers over here. The first answer, it is, okay, let's assume that we are having really zero, zero, zero information, or other words, let's assume that we are totally dumb. So if it is the case, then what I have to do, it is I have to perform an average over the whole set of unitary matrices, which they are with equal probability. And if I do something like that, then random matrix theory, it gives me an expression which is nothing else than a linear behavior of the form factor up to the rescale time tau equal to 1, and then a saturation. The saturation, it is really something trivial. It is coming from the autocorrelation at the same point, which is a delta function. The Fourier transform has to give me a constant thing. This is slightly an interesting part, and it's slightly interesting part because the next step that you would like to do, it is somehow to restrict the averaging according to some new game. And the new game, it is that you will impose some type of restriction, namely you will assume that you are having symmetry, time reversal symmetry. Now, if you are having a time reversal symmetry, then the averaging cannot go over the whole set of unitary matrices, but in fact it will be restricted to symmetric unitary matrices with equal probability, and if you do something like that, you are coming out with a form factor which has this shape, and one has to contrast it with the upper plot. You see again that I'm coming to the saturation from the same reasoning as previously, so this is a boring area, while this guy over here, it is quite interesting. It shows difference with respect to the linear behavior, and this is what people they are calling weak localization phenomenon. It's in fact a trace of the symmetry over which you are imposed to do the averaging. Okay, so this is what random matrix theory is doing, and then you are coming to the next question, which says, okay, let's assume that you are having extra restrictions, and these extra restrictions, they are coming because of some rules that you have to obey as far as the classical dynamics is concerned. After all, if I am a particle and I'm moving all around, I know that once I will arrive to this obstacle, I have to reflect it back. And this is a restriction which is imposed by my classical dynamics, and it has to be implemented in my averaging as some type of a constraint. Now, as far as this type of restriction is concerned, random matrix theory is dumped. And then the question is what we can do. And what we can do, it is semi-classics. It is a thing that we like really a lot because it has to do with orbits. And ourselves, we are classical creatures, so we understand orbits. It is a good theory for us. Now, however, this type of restrictions, they are creating a set of problems. And it is true that within this approach, there was not success, at least not until recently. And you can see that this type of restriction, they can lead to severe deviations from the predictions of random matrix theory. Here I am plotting again the random matrix theory results with a black line here and there. And you can see the form factor associated from a metallic wire. And you can see that it has strong deviations, at least at the origin, and this is associated with specific periodic orbits. While over here, I have the form factor for a system which is at criticality, like the star graph that it was discussed in this talk. And again, you can see that it is totally different with respect to the random matrix theory considerations, and you want to understand it. Now, once you will arrive at this point and you realize that...
This is analytical or numerical?
These are experimental results in the sense of numerics. This, however, it is an analytical calculation. Keating, Berkolaiko, and Bogomolny have provided an answer on this thing, I think, 99.
Pseudo-integrable.
Say it again, please.
It's not the pseudo-integrable system.
Okay, it is the star graph in the specific case.
One around perturbation, which is not pseudo-integrable.
Okay. So... So once you will arrive at this point, as I said previously, the question that it comes next, it is, can you build models which they are allowing you to, you know, to perform this type of restrictions in a controllable way and allow you also at the same time to develop mathematical tools which, you know, you can take them later on and use them to real systems? And that was actually, at the same time, you want these models to be simple enough, because otherwise, you know, mathematical complexity will be too high for you. And at the same time, you want to be generic, these models. In other words, you want these models, you know, to keep specific features of the dynamics. And that was actually the starting point which led us to develop this type of systems, which already, you know, various people in this conference, they presented. This is a graph. And in fact, that was the starting figure or the starting calculation which moved us towards the direction of graphs. And what we have done, we took this very simple graph, a tetrahedra, and we calculated the spectrum of this type of a system, and we compared with respect to the random matrix theory predictions. And as you can see, the deviation, it was really small, it was less than 1%. So that means that this very simple model, which in fact you can treat it analytically quite well, preserve the features of universality, therefore it's a good model to do analysis and calculations. Not only that, but what it turns out it is that these things, they are not only models that theoretical physicists can draw in a piece of paper or a mathematician can use in order to calculate various quantities, but these things, they are real and they appear also in various laboratories. So the form factor, one of the form factors that I show you actually is coming from an experiment. And here there are three different type of experimental situations where quantum graphs can be used. This is coming from the group of Abilio, where he used superconducting wires connected in a complicated way, and he put this type of a construction in a magnetic field, and he studied a phenomenon which is called the caving phenomenon, namely due to interferences associated not with Anderson localization but with the magnetic field which is perpendicular. In some of these wires, you have zero probability to exist. And this is another example. This is coming from a microwave experiment. These are waveguides connected in the shape of a tetrahedron. There are four of these guys. And Circo, recently, 2004, he built this thing in the Polish Academy of Science. He calculated the form factor for this type of a system. There is a new challenge, actually, in this direction, and it is coming from ultra-cold gases, where you can take an optical guide, and this is an example coming from the group of Aspect. There are various other groups that they can build this type of optical guides, and you are loading them with matter waves. And one of the things that you would like to understand is what are the properties of this type of constructions. I will come back to this at the last part of my talk. Now, how a physicist or a mathematician will build a graph, I will go step by step. This is the simplest possible graph that you can ever imagine. It is the exercise that we all had to do in the first wave course in the university. You are taking the time-independent Schrödinger equation, and you need to solve it on a line. And the most general solution that you imagine over there, it is a superposition of two plane waves, one moving on the left and another moving on the right. And you are having these coefficients alpha left and alpha right, or vice versa. And these two coefficients, they determine uniquely the solution once you will impose some boundary conditions in your domain. What is the next step of complexity as far as networks is concerned? You take many of these lines, edges, and you are tie them together at one point, which you will call it a vertex, and then you are creating the first non-trivial graph, which is the star graph or the hydra graph. And what you have to do again, you have to impose boundary conditions at the point where all these edges, they are connected together. And you can do this in terms of a scattering matrix, which I call it with a small capital letter, with a small letter sigma. Of course, this matrix over there, it is a scattering matrix which connects the incoming waves with the outgoing ones. And it has to fulfill the unitarity because of current conservation. In the specific case, also, it is symmetric because you have time reversal symmetry. Now, I will restrict myself in cases with where the sigma, it is k wave vector independent. Of course, you can build other type of boundary conditions, but for the purposes of these talks, what I'm planning to discuss here, this is already enough. So what is the next level of building a more serious graph? It is to take many of these vertices together and build such type of a construction, the tetrahedra, the pentahedron, the hexahedron, whatever you like. It can go up to infinity. You want to discuss the dynamics of a particle in this type of a construction, and the dynamics, it is very simple. How you are building it? Well, it consists of two parts. One part, it is associated with the free evolution at the bond. So once you are starting from this point, you are evolving freely up to this vertex over there, and during this evolution, you are gaining a simple phase, which is e to the ik ld, where ld it is just the length of this bond. And then once you will arrive over there, you are getting a kick. So the vertex, it is a singular point in your dynamics. It gives you a kick, and this kick, it will take you in any other bond that is connected with this specific vertex, and it is compatible with your grammar. Namely, it can take you back, or it can take you over here, or it can take you over there. And how you will jump anywhere, this is an information that it is encoded in the small sigma matrix that I discussed just previously, and has to do with the boundary conditions at this point. So the evolution operator, it is just decomposed in two parts, the free evolution and the kick part of the evolution. What about stationary modes associated with this type of construction? Well, this is very simple. In fact, this is something that Schalker done at the beginning of the 90s in another context, though. What you have to do in order to find the stationary or the eigenstates that they are living in this type of a construction, you have to apply the evolution operator. And if this application it gives you again the same state, then you know that this is a stationary state. And using this condition, then you are coming out with a secular equation, namely the determinant 1 minus u of k, where the k, it is entering through the free evolution, it has to be equal to 0, and all the k's that they are fulfilling this condition, they are associated with stationary modes of in this construction. You can build a classical analog associated with this quantum mechanical evolution. Of course, it has a set of drawbacks, but I'm not here really to discuss the drawbacks of this classical analog. I'm here to discuss the glorious outcome of this thing. And the way that you will build up the classical analog, you will consider some type of a Markov process that takes place on this construction, and the corresponding Per-Frobenius operator that describe the evolution of the flow, it will be given by the absolute value square of the matrix elements of the quantum mechanical evolution operator. So you take this guy over there, absolute value square the matrix elements, this gives you the probability to jump from one bond to another, and this is how your classical evolution it will be done. Now notice that by doing this type of classical construction, I'm losing totally all the information about the metric of my graph. So anything that is associated with the length, it is lost through this absolute value square. The only thing that it remains through this construction, it is the topology. Namely, which bond is connected with what. You can calculate the eigenvalues of this operator, and you will find that it has a maximum eigenvalue 1, which is associated with the equidistribution. Everything uniformly spread all over this construction, and all the other eigenvalues, they are smaller than 1. The rate with which you are approaching this equidistribution is what people usually they are calling the mixing rate. And it is given by this expression over here. Okay. And up to that point, which was already more than half of my talk, I succeeded to do nothing more than repeating what most of the people had already presented here. Now, let's see what I can do with this type of a construction, and again, I will do this in the frame of semi-classics. Let's start with spectral properties. And let's use as an exhibition toy the form factor which we defined it in that specific way, where here I'm going to perform an average over the wave vectors k, and notice by performing this type of averaging, I will respect all the classical restrictions that the classical dynamics is imposing to me. Again, I remind to you that the k is entering through the free evolution as e to the ikl by taking absolute value and defining the classical evolution, then the grammar or the allowing jumps, they are still there. What is missing, it is the topology. So I have now a model over which I can operate, and I can perform an averaging, which is very legitimate averaging, since it keeps unaffected the rules of the game. Now, I can go a step further, and I can calculate the trace. I can open it in these specific ways. The next step that I'm going to do, it is, so this is associated with a specific periodic orbit of period T, and the TD and the DT and the D1, they have to be the same point in order to close my loop. And the next step that I will have to do, it is actually to break these matrix elements in two parts. One part which is associated with the topology of my dynamics, namely with the small sigma matrices that I described previously. And the other part, it is the part which is associated with the free evolution. Now I can group these two terms together. This is associated with the stability of my periodic orbit. And this guy over here, I can sum it up, and it will give me the length of the orbit. As a next step, I will take inside the averaging over here in this summation, and if I do something like that, and I will assume that the lengths of the bonds, they are rationally related with one another, this thing, it will collapse to a delta function of orbits that they are having the same length. And this actually, it was a very nice step, because at that point it allowed us to turn these ugly summations over double sum over periodic orbits to a sum over families of periodic orbits of the same length. And the second sum, it was nothing else than a coherent sum over orbits of the same period. In fact, at that time, we were able to do the next step, which was the diagonal approximation. That was not really a big thing, but nevertheless, it was a nice thing. Namely, we consider over there correlations of periodic orbits, or pairs of orbits that they are correlated in the sense that they are not only the same length, but they are exactly retracing one another. And that was actually the idea of Michael Bay back at 85. And if you do something like that, this double sum collapses to a single sum of the same set of periodic orbits. And this AP, absolute value squared, sum over P, it is nothing else than the trace of the classical operator mu to the power T. And this, since it has only one eigenvalue, which is 1, and all the others, they are smaller than 1, it goes in the semi-classical limit, which I consider it to be the limit of t goes to infinity, b goes to infinity, by keeping this ratio constant, then this guy over here goes to 1, and I stay with tau, where gamma, it is just the symmetry issue. Okay, and the next step, it was done essentially with Holger at the very, very beginning of 2001. In fact, it was done at 2000, where we were at that time quite ambitious, and we tried to sum up this series. And in fact, we had succeeded to do this for by just a combinatorial technology. But we've done it, of course, for very small graphs, for V equal to 4. Already for V equal to 5, you can see, probably you cannot see. But over here, what you had to see it is that there are two sets of points. One, they are the cycles, which they are stopping up to one point. That was the point where we were able to trace all possible periodic orbits. And then, of course, as time was going farther, we were not able to count for farther periodic orbits. And, of course, if the graph is even bigger, then we were stopping essentially at the very beginning and we were not able to reproduce anything more. At that time, and in fact, 5 months later, 6 months later, these two guys, they came, Martin came with a really brilliant idea how to perform this sum, and essentially he said that, you know, on top of what Berry had done, where he took orbits that they are correlated in the sense that they are self-tracing to one another, he said, you know, take orbits that they are having one intersection, and then they are one of their part they are transversing it in the same way, while the other part they are transversing it in an opposite way. This is a such type of a pair, and you can see that this orbit, which I mark it with red, it has one intersection point, which is this thing over there, and you can see with respect to its pair, it is essentially this part, it is transverse in exactly the same order, while this part, it is transverse in the opposite one. And Marty said that if you consider corrections coming from these families of orbits, then you will be able to come out with the weak localization corrections. And indeed, that was the case. People, 2000 people, and I mean Berkolaiko, Sanz, and Whitney, at 2001, they used this technology and they were able to reproduce to the corrections to the form factor to the second order. In fact, I believe that Gregory went farther to the third order by himself or together with the others. Now, as far as the form factor is concerned, there was a huge activity with the graphs. The list here, it is by far from being complete. Of course, I cite always my friends. this is... I would like to remark the work of Bogomoli, Berkolaiko, and Keating on the star graphs. And also, I would like to mark the very beautiful work of Knutzmann and Atlan, which was 2004. I will not discuss this because Sven already went through this. Okay, so that's nice as far as the form factor is concerned. What can you do about wave functions? And this is the next thing that it will bother me over here. And one of the issues that it appears in the statistical properties or in the analysis of wave function of chaotic system, it is this phenomenon, the scattering phenomenon, namely the unexpected probability concentration around some unstable periodic orbit like the one that it is over here. And again, this figure, it is taken without the permission of Ann Becker from Dresden. Okay, and what really you can do, there are a couple of theories traced back, the oldest one is traced back to Heller, who was able to connect the localization trace of the wave functions to a dynamical observable, namely the survival probability. In order to do something like that, I will review very briefly his construction. What he done, he calculated the survival amplitude. This is the initial state that you are starting, and you are taking the evolution operator at the time t. This is a survival, and sandwich with the initial state again. This is a survival amplitude at the time t. You take absolute value square of this guy over there. You have just to substitute, and you are coming with this expression over there, and the next step that you are aiming to do, it is to do some calculations. Now, I will do calculations with the right-hand side in a second, but for a moment, let me concentrate with the left-hand side. Now, if you consider that you want to describe the quantum evolution for short times, then quantum classical consideration arguments, they tell you that maybe you can... you can approximate this quantum survival probability with the classical analog of it. And indeed, this is what we have done over here. And if you do something like that, I have done it for the case of a Newman graph. What you can see over there, it is that contributions to the classical survival probability from short periodic orbits and their repetitions, namely periodic orbits that they are associated with reflection, you are starting over there, you are going at this vertex, you are reflected back, and then you are reflected again back, accumulate amplitudes which they are reflection amplitudes, and these reflection amplitudes they go like 2 over V minus 1, where V it is the valency of the specific graph, while orbits that they are going all around, they are accumulating a lot of transmission amplitudes which they are going like 2 over V, and in the limit of big graph, where V fully connected graph, where B, V it goes to infinity, this guy over there goes to zero, while this guy goes to one, and therefore the contribution to the survival probability using this argument, you are concluding that it is mainly for short unstable periodic orbits of this type over there. So you calculate this to the power square because you are having the probability, not the probability amplitude, to the power t, and this t you can see that for odd values it is zero simply because all these type of orbits they need to have two reflections. I remind to you the scheme, you have to reflect here and then you reflect there in order to come back. And you calculate the classical expectation, which is the red cycles over there, and you calculate also the quantum calculations, and you can see that for relatively large times, these two things, they are matching one another. Therefore, indeed, you can approximate the left-hand side of this equality with the classical survival probability. Now, let's work out slightly the right-hand side of this guy, and in order to do something like that, let me perform a time averaging. Now, I will consider that this time is much, much larger than the Heisenberg time over which I'm doing this averaging, and what this thing it will allow me, it will allow me to turn this exponential to a delta function, which eventually to collapse this double sum to this quantity over there, and this is nothing else than what Auriol discussed in his talk. Namely, it is actually it's not the participation ratio, but because I don't divide, but it is the inverse participation number, and this is actually a measure of how localized or delocalized is my wave function. This quantity, it is bounded by 1 and by 1 over 2b. This is the case where I have fully ergodic state, like the one that I draw over here. And this is the case where I have a very localized in one bond state, like the graph that I have over there. So based on the left-hand side argument, you are expecting that if you calculate the distributions of the inverse participation numbers, you will see many a strong component associated with this type of orbits, namely because these were the orbits that they're contributing in this sum over here. We have done this type of calculation. We calculated the distribution of the inverse participation number, and to our surprise, what we have found it is that strong scars associated with the less unstable periodic orbits, like this one, they are essentially invisible. That was somehow contradicting the technology introduced by Heller and essentially led us to the conclusion that weak scarring associated with the bulk of the wave functions and strong scarring phenomena, they are really unrelated effects, and therefore a better theory for scarring has to be created. In fact, by doing this type of a calculation, we were able to give conditions over which you have to observe scarring. And in fact, the condition it is a stricter version of the one that you are having in billiards, where you are having Bose quantization along the periodic path. Here we came out with the conclusion that you need to have a Bose-Sommerfeld along each segment specifically. But this is what I wanted to talk about scars, and I want to convey a negative message at this point, that a better theory for scarring is needed. Okay, let me go to the for the last 10 minutes of my talk, let me go to the last part, which is associated with dynamical aspects and semi-classics, And one of the motivations, it came essentially from this type of an experiment, which came from the fine group of Neil Davidson at the Weizmann Institute. And let me describe very briefly the experiment. He created an optical trap, which had the shape of a Bunimovich stadium. The dynamics, it was chaotic over there, or predominantly chaotic. And he loaded this thing with cold atoms, rubidium atoms, and then what he measured, it was the percentage of the atom remaining in the trap at any instant of time. Now, in the main part of the figure, you see two families of symbols. One, it is the filled ones, which are the measurements of Davidson, and the other, they are the open ones, which are the results of the classical dynamics. As you can imagine, the classical dynamics shows an exponential a decay signature of the chaoticity of the system, while while the measurements, the experimental measurements, they show a consistent deviation from the classical expectation, which was from above, indicating the importance of interference phenomena. And that was the motivation to go to the next subject, but before going over there, one has really to turn your graph to a scattering object. Because up to now I talk about compact graphs, but now I am having open geometry, so I have to turn the graphs to an open one, and that was the next step in our odyssey as far as graph is concerned. Namely, we took a compact graph and we connected with leads that they are going to infinity, and therefore we turned the system to an open one. Now, once you will do something like that, the operator that you care to write down, it is the scattering matrix, which essentially connects the incoming wave with the outgoing one. And I will not go in details into the constructions, which they are very simple. I will give you the formula that it comes out, and I will give a physical intuition about how you have to read these type of things. Essentially, it consists of the following parts. This operator tau over there, it is nothing else than an operator that it couples you from outside to inside. So you are outside, and then you need somebody to push you in. This is what this guy over here is doing. This is its job. Now, this guy over there, it is the evolution operator inside this type of a construction, and the U tilde, it is a subunitary evolution operator, which takes into consideration the fact that your graph is not compact, but it is leaky. So, in fact, if you expand this, provided that this is subunitary and it is from your construction, then you see immediately that this guy, it accounts for multiple scattering events that they take place within the scattering area. And of course, at the point where you finish your journey inside over there, you need to go outside. So the thing that it will push you outside is essentially the inverse of this guy over there, which is the T dagger. So it will take you from inside outside. And of course, you have to consider the situation where you are having direct process. That means that from shooting from outside, you can immediately go out, or immediately you can exit. And this is actually a diagonal matrix R that it is written over there. Now, once you will do this type of a construction, you are coming out with this subunitary evolution operator, which defines the evolution inside the leaky graph. And since it's subunitary, that means that it doesn't preserve the norm. Therefore, the norm to be inside, it decays as a function of time, and always it is more or equal to 1. You can build a classical dynamics in a similar manner, namely by taking the absolute value square of the subunitary evolution operator, which is going to evolve your flow inside the system. You can calculate the eigenvalues of this operator. It has the maximum one, which is e to the minus gamma classical. I wrote it in that way. Okay, it is M1, if you wish. I can always write it in that way. And all the others. And this guy over there is associated with the equidistribution. You can calculate the probability to stay inside classically by just taking a summation over here. And this eventually, it gives you a decay, which is e to the minus gamma classical t. Now, I will not go through these things, But what I would like to conclude on this part, it is the fact that eventually you can again apply the same trick that Zipper and Richter, they told us, and in principle, you can try to... So you are coming out with a periodic orbit formula for the survival probability, which is very reminiscent of the previous one over here. Let me move slightly faster over there because I want really to go to the last part of this talk. And what you can do, it is, again, you can write down the contributions from the diagonal approximation orbits that they are tracing one another exactly, and this gives you, again, the classical decay. And you can go above the diagonal approximation by considering orbits that they are different only in one part, and the difference, it is nothing else than how you are transversing this specific part, and this is such type of an orbit, where the A segment and the C segment, they are transversing in a similar way, while the B segment, in one case, it is transversed in that way, while in the other case, it is transversed in that way. And if you do calculate the contributions coming from over here, you are coming out with a T-square correction with respect to the diagonal approximation. And then let me go to this last part. This is a work that we started a couple of months, actually, slightly more than a couple of months. And the motivation, essentially, it was this type of a construction. So you can take an optical guide, and you can load it with a BEC there. And, of course, you can envision the situation where you don't have only one optical guide, but you are taking many of them connected together, and you can build the simplest possible network model, namely the Hydra. And if you do something like that, then you would like to describe how the condensate behaves as a type of a construction. Now, in the midfield approximation, the condensate, it can be described by the Gross-Pitaevsky equation, which is written in this way, and people, they have various names, nonlinear Schrödinger equation is another thing, and it comes also... The same shape, it appears also in the frame of nonlinear optics. And the next, this is actually a work that Joshua Bonifeld is pursuing now. And of course, once you will come out with this, let me give you a set of definitions about the various things that they appear over there. This psi RT, it is nothing else than the single particle density, the total one you need to multiply with an n, where n it is the number of atoms that you are having. U over here, it is the atom-atom interaction term, which involves the number of particles and the mass of them, and also the scattering length alpha. And in this research line, we will consider cases where we are having repulsing interaction, namely the scattering length, it is tuned in such a way that it is positive. Now, in this type of a construction, there's one length scale that it is entering, and it's quite important, and this is what people they are calling the healing length. And this is nothing else than the average density times the scattering length to the minus 1/2. And the physical meaning of the healing length, it is the length which above which you don't see, I can put it in this way, above which you are restoring the mean density behavior. So you need to be above this length in order not to see boundary effects or impurity effects phenomena. And I will consider, actually, I will go even down in my considerations. Namely, I will consider quasi-antigeometry. After all, I have a waveguide over there. Namely, I will consider that lambda y and lambda z, they are of the order of the healing length, while the lambda x, it is much, much larger. So this parameter, Greek lambda, the ratio, it defines me how good my approximations they are or how bad they are not. Now, once you will do something like that, then the next thing that you would like to ask it is, can you discuss about the states that they are supported from this type of a construction? Of course, you cannot really talk about spectra or whatever, but I don't really care to describe the spectrum. What I will care, it is to analyze and describe a special family of solutions which I can decompose them in this specific way. These are stationary solutions where I can, the spatial part, I can decompose it in psi x and the y and z, while the time, I will put it in that way. Now, I can do something like that. I can integrate over the y and z, and then I'm coming out with this equation, which I can call time-dependent Schrödinger equation, and mu over there, it is nothing else than the chemical potential of my system. I can solve this equation, and actually, this is a work that goes back to Zakharov and Sabbat at 72, maybe even later, and recently also Carr, Clark, and Reinhardt, they solve this type of equation. It admits solutions, and I'm talking about the case of a star graph. It admits solutions of the elliptic sinuses. And notice that I can substitute this guy over there. And if I substitute it and I request that this is correct for all x, then what I have to do it is I have to take the constant term equal to the chemical potential. And this gives me a connection between this parameter kappa, which in a second, I will tell you in the linear limit what it gives me, this index pi, which is nothing else than the index of the elliptic integral, and the interaction term over here, u. Now, notice that if I do something like that, I'm coming out with these relations, and in the linear case where u, it goes equal to 0, then the pi, which is the elliptic index, it goes to 0. In such type of case, the elliptic sinus goes to the sinus, which is a solution of the linear graph, provided that I am putting the appropriate boundary conditions, which is Dirichlet at the edges and Neumann at the head of the hydra. And this kappa that it appears over there, it is nothing else than the wavelength, k. So this is a check for the linear case, and once I do this, I can start now going and trying to find properties of my solutions. And this is a step beyond 2 seconds, and I can try to do it. I will request continuity at the specific point where all these bonds, they are connected, and also I will request current conservation. If I do something like that, then I'm coming out with this secular equation, and in fact, I have also the normalization. Now, notice that with respect to the linear case, now here, the k, or the kappas, actually, they are bond-dependent. So I have the index b over there. And also, the index of the elliptic function, it is b-dependent as well. So the problem, it is becoming much more complicated. Nevertheless, we can do it, at least at this point on the numerical level. And at least the statement that I would like to convey to you as far as time allows me, it is that you can do something like that, and you come out with the following statement, that there is a nonlinearity parameter u above which topological solitons, they emerge in your construction, and here is the case of a pentagon, first bond, second, third, fourth, and fifth bond, where you can see here there are various, so I'm plotting the shape of the one particle wave function, and you can see that from the case of the zero nonlinearity, so the linear graph, it starts evolves, and then there is a u critical above which I'm coming out with this kink type of a behavior. The kink, it starts evolving at the points where you are having the nodes. What you can see on the upper part of this plot, it is nothing else than the chemical potential plotted versus the energy level N. And again, what you are observing, it is that an energy level critical, let's call it again, above which you are recovering. And this is actually the plot that you can see if you go in this direction. You are recovering the structure of your chaotic wave function, below which you are having dark solitons. Okay, I will not go through the explanation of what is this and critical, but what actually I will go to, and this is actually the last transparency that I will show to you, and it came yesterday night around 11 o'clock, so, but I check it until 12, so I'm pretty confident about it. What actually we've done, and that was a motivation that I got from this talk, it was the following. We measure the number of nodes that they are appearing in my solutions, and the thing that we found actually it is, so Z0, it is the number of modes versus the index level, the energy level N. And Z0, it is the case for zero nonlinearity. Z, it is various scalars corresponds to various type of nonlinearities. And what we were able to observe, it is if we plot it in that specific way, we are having an abnormal number of modes, not for the ground level, which is 1, but starting from 2, that they are created once you are introducing nonlinearity. And this is actually one of the things that we have to go and work further, but this is what we are doing right now, and I wanted to share our activity with you. And this is actually my last transparency. I showed to you that quantum well, this is really the last transparency. You see, this goes together with the genes. Probably you know that at some point there was this Trojan horse where... So, previous transparency it was the Trojan horse to keep you here. And this is actually the last transparency. I summarize. I hope that I convince you that quantum networks, they are easy to treat. And in fact, it's not me that done the work. The previous speakers, they done a much better job than me. At least the mathematical part. I also try to convince you that they are useful to study, useful object in order to study spectral and wave function statistics. Useful for quantum dissipation problems. This is an activity that we are pursuing together with Doron and Holger since last year. I didn't talk about it because... And that was the thing that I shared with you, and I thank you very much for your attention.
And his coffee privilege is taken away.